Okay, let's take a moment to pray, then I'll introduce our speaker and we'll see what happens next. Lord, we thank you for the beauty of your creation, for the technology you give us, but also we pray wisdom in looking over its abuse and that you teach us to protect not only our children, but those who come to us as clients. Pray for Lee today that you'd give her clear words and that those would be useful to us. We pray, Lord, in Christ's name. Amen. Some privileges sometime, but today I get to introduce my daughter-in-law. She, as my wife, is a dangerous person. There was a time we were doing co-therapy together with a young couple who would arrive at the fishbowl and they'd say, "We're here to see the Hurleys," and they would have this grin on their face. So we're doing premarital with a couple, and as we're going along, we get to some of the intimate topics, and they look over at her and say, "That's your father-in-law, right?" That didn't faze her. And then I wasn't clear enough, so she says, "Hey, sometimes you're not really very clear. Could you say that again more simply?" Mind you, this is your senior professor and your father-in-law. Okay, so this is a person without fear. I've been working and failed to instill fear for about a decade, more than that. But I expect that today you'll hear very much kind of where Lee is and what she has to say. She's come through this program, has been in private practice in several locations, worked for a number of years for Tulane University in their counseling center, and now works a lot in Mobile with schools and so on, looking exactly at these issues around smartphones, screens, and what those are doing for or to your children. So we invited her to come up today and to speak. A lot of you are looking at little children. Lee will tell you how early it is they begin to study those screens. And then others of you are working with adolescents, and they have all their screens up and running. They can show their parents how to get where they need to go, or even their friends. I guess, old enough to be most of their grandfathers, but some of you are too old for what the 8-year-olds are now doing on their screens. So we're glad to have you here. The time is all yours. You tell them when we break and not. And when you end the break, start right on time, and you'll have an empty room when you do that. But start on time anyway. Okay. Thanks for coming.
Thank y'all. Well, I guess y'all didn't really have me. They had me. But I'm glad to be here. This topic, there's my coffee and my hero. Sorry. Stephanie was bringing me coffee. This topic, y'all will very much hear, is probably the topic at current that I am most passionate about. Hi, Barb. You're good. You're okay. Thank you. So I'm passionate about a lot of topics. I do believe that this issue is the single biggest threat to the development of children and the sanctity of intimacy, as well as the stability of families. As y'all will see, and I'll speak to, because of the relative newness of smartphones, the longitudinal studies aren't clear enough, or they're not saying definitively what the impact is. A lot of what I speak to, yes, there has been studies and research, but there's still research coming. So in a lot of what I speak to is just anecdotal in what I am experiencing now in my practice. I predominantly work with kids from an upper middle class background, save a few. I'm also in various schools, public schools, which lends itself to lower socioeconomic brackets. I have FaceTime and interaction and anecdotal evidence just based on who I'm interacting with. And it's daunting. This is not going to be a happy talk, I will forewarn you. So I push this button. Which button do I push? The red one? The point? Where?
I got Well,
I can stand over there if I need to. He did it. There you go.
Okay, so I hit the bottom one. Yeah, so that's back, that's forward.
Okay. And I point it that way?
Yeah. Bottom one.
Okay, so just breakdown of the agenda. And I can get this PowerPoint to y'all. Really, this is more of my guide, but if y'all want it, I'm going to email it to the powers that be, and you can get it from them. Okay. So these are the topics where I'm going to start with. I'm going to walk through just what we want to see and what is expected and what is common for just typical child and teen development, what their basic needs are, what the new normal looks like, the impact of sex pornography, its prevalence, and the impact on these kids' life trajectory. Clinical implications, including what you're going to see, maybe what you already are seeing in clinic. And hopefully to end on a positive note of things that we can do to be proactive to hopefully offset some of these consequences. Here's my self-care alert. A lot of sexual content. For those of you who have sexual trauma in your background, just take care of yourself if you need to leave, et cetera. Some of the content that we talk about can be triggering and very overwhelming as well. Pornography, y'all will hear, touches almost half of families in our country. So, and I know some of you that applies. So just encourage y'all to take care of yourself or dismiss yourself, whatever you need to do. To self-care. All right. An African proverb says it takes a village to raise a child. Well, we no longer have a village. We have a global community that is increasingly disconnected and fragmented. This site that I quote, educateempowerkids.org, is one that I will provide in your resources, and it's something that I would encourage you to tattoo on your brain. All right, pre-adolescent. If y'all think back to just basic attachment needs. So in birth, you have a child. Ideally, even through pregnancy, seeing familiar faces. Ideally, in pregnancy, mom is developing an emotional connection with baby, even in utero. Moving on into, say, the birth process. Ideally, mom is connected to that experience. You know, the research shows, you know, the more emotionally in tune mom is with that experience, and the immediate after the baby is born, being connected to the child, baby at breast, et cetera. Those first hours are very crucial in terms of setting the stage for that baby's attachment to mom. I want a show of hands of how many of you have seen a picture posted on Facebook of a freshly hatched baby just born. Right? If you do the timestamp, you often can see that picture was posted on Facebook within minutes or a half hour of that baby being born. You can ask nurses the number of families, husbands included, that are scrolling while they're in the hospital, that are posting. I had an acquaintance that was blogging about her baby being born the same day he was born. It's very common. So what happens is, literally for many, within hours of being born, there's already beginning this detachment, this distraction. So one of the key things infants need is eye contact, right? When they're being fed, whether they're bottle fed or breastfed. It's intended to be a time where there's an exchange between mom and baby, a bonding time. Now what we have is mom feeding while scrolling, or taking pictures, or there's a disconnect. So it used to be that, like, night feedings are the sacred space between mom and baby. Now you hear all the time. Actually, as an example, I have an acquaintance that started a mom's group. In theory, it's a genius idea, and she called it Midnight Milk Bar because she noticed about how the volume of women and friends that were posting online in the middle of the night while they were awake with their children. So in and of itself, no, in a vacuum, maybe that's not so bad, but I think it points to how early this disconnect begins, and to varying degrees, obviously. Play. Children need to play more than ever. There are many schools that children do not get recess, and they get about 20 minutes of PE twice a week. I know for the public schools in my area, removing recess is the key discipline. Removing recess and silent lunches. So now we have kids that are sitting still for 8 hours a day, some of which is screen time, and the discipline measure for the classroom, entire classroom, is removal of recess and a silent lunch. So they go to lunch and they're not allowed to speak, and if they do, there's further consequence, going to the principal's office, things of this nature. This is not abnormal. We lived it with our daughter for the past 2 years until this year, which we moved schools. So it's take inventory. Those of you who have children, I'm sure that you may be familiar with this, especially if they're in the public school system. Those of you who don't have children and do have acquaintances, I would ask them, do your teachers do this? And it happens many times in private schools. It's not just public schools. But play is being viewed as a luxury as opposed to meeting a basic need. They need to be physical. If you think about letting out, like, so if someone's suffering with anxiety or managing anger, one of the key things you do as a clinician, as an intervention, is to advocate for physical activity, for exercise. In terms of emotions, it's so depressing to me to go to a restaurant. Kids don't know how to look a server in the eye and order food. Sitting at a table, almost at least one person is on their phone scrolling. Almost always the children are holding an iPhone or an iPad. And so what's happening? The kids from a very young age are not learning how to sit still in a restaurant, how to order, how to have conversation, how to cue to various just social cues. And a restaurant is just one example. It happens, you know, in various arenas. Even going over to a friend's house. Let's say parents are going over to have dinner at a friend's house. Understandably, parents want parent adult time. The best babysitter in the world is an iPad. It's like the baby silencer. I've done it. But it's true. And so kids don't learn, hey, we're having grown-up time. Y'all need to self-entertain. They're given a phone or they're given an iPad because their presence is annoying. Which we all get annoyed by children, of course. The problem is that they become more irritable with each passing minute on a screen, as does the parent. So, basic eye contact, literacy. There's one study that shows that the ratio is, it would be the equivalent of 2 hours to screen time per every 10 seconds of reading. And so kids are not reading. And you know, there's some controversy over Kindles, right? A lot of people like to download books. I personally do not recommend that. In our house, you smell a paper book and you flip the pages. There's just, as you know, there's just a difference in being able to hold a book and flip it and read the pages and engage it in ways that you can't on a screen. But reading is not what children are doing on their Kindles or iPads. They're playing games and they're on social media. I'm sure that y'all have heard Dr. Hurley talk about mirror neurons. He loves mirror neurons. So with all of these things, if you just look at the parent and what the child is absorbing, and or if the parent is disciplining while checking social media or taking a picture of this child and screaming at this child, happens all the time. In the world of mirror neurons, what is being reflected back and forth? Movement, gross and fine motor skills. So I'll get into the statistics, but there's a significant portion of humans that's first exposure to a device and even regular use is from 0 to 1. I have a 14-month-old. I mean, by age 8, you can swipe, scroll, which is the genius of Mac, right? I'm always bugged by this push in schools for technology, technology, technology. You can train a monkey to use a computer. You can't teach them to have human empathy, and you can't teach them social cues. It is not hard to learn basic computer functions to function in society. It's easily absorbed. The stuff that comes without its use is not easily absorbed later in life, which is why they need to absorb it when they're younger. So with movement, gross and fine motor skills. Different children are different. My middle child, she's never been interested in anything that has to do with the screen. My oldest child and my youngest, if that screen is on, they will sit there all day long. What it is that makes some children more engaged than others, I'm not totally sure. So it's hard. You have to, and I'm going to get into the boundary setting, but it's really nice when I'm trying to do stuff. I can turn on baby signing time, which is fairly benign if she's watching it for 30 minutes, but it can easily become 4 hours, easily and very quickly. And she's 14 months old. Sleep in spades, we see that screen time disrupts sleep. Find me a teenager that does not sleep with that phone by their bed. Just the proximity of the phone to the bed affects sleep. It affects it in adults as well. For those of you who work with people or you yourself have sleep issues, the recommended protocol if you're getting into a regimen to perfect your sleep hygiene is to it be a minimum of an hour before you begin your bedtime routine to not have interacted with the screen because of the stimulation in your brain. And so what we're seeing now is kids, sleepy time quote, let's put in a cartoon and wind it down. It's a faux winding down. So kids aren't resting like they need to. Some kids can't settle. So the parent has been through this winding down thing, and perhaps benign. A lot of this is a benign neglect issue. And then they're frustrated because the kid's hyper as soon as they get in bed. And that has many, many, the correlation between the screen and hyperactivity is huge. So these are their needs. They need sleep. On, I think the recommended sleep for 8+ through the teen years is 10 to 12 hours. No, 8 to 10 hours. For little ones, toddler years, infancy, it's around 14 hours. So, and it's crucial to their development and their growth and their health that they sleep and rest. So children aren't sleeping like they need to. Oop, wrong one. Oh, yeah. The new normal. So I'm going to go over the statistics. Addictive factors, how things have been normalized, how children are becoming desensitized and defiant. And then within the new normal, understanding what their world is within the world of social media. Can I just get a show of hands of who in here, I don't do math, so I can't think numbers. Who in here had a smartphone in high school? Okay. High school, college is when it hit, right? Okay. So here's some statistics. The average American devotes an average of 8 to 10 hours a day of screen time. 85% use a second device while watching TV. 72% of children 8 and younger regularly use a smartphone or smart device, 8 and younger. Parents spend more than 9 hours a day with media screen time, with the vast majority of that time spent on personal social media sites. 78% of parents believe they are good technology role models for their children. I want to go back to the former statistic. Parents spend more than 9 hours a day with media screen time. 56% of parents worry that their child will become addicted to technology. Fair concern. 52% of all children have access to a smart device, including 10% of 0 to 1 year olds. 50% of teens report feeling addicted to their phone. And 41% of teens report feeling that their parent does not pay attention to them when they are together because they are on their phone. That statistic breaks my heart. And I will tell y'all that in my practice, without fail, when I ask the question, if you could change anything when you're with your parents, particularly with mom, what would you change? She would put the freaking phone down, is what they all say. It is estimated that the average teenager spends more time on social media than they do sleeping. I told y'all this wasn't going to be a happy talk. So in the world of addiction risks, there's a debate currently on whether or not technology addiction, screen addictions, is going to be categorized, how it's going to be categorized, if it's going to be its separate diagnosis in the DSM. So again, I think I spoke to that in the beginning, that instead I think it's important for us to look at what is most obvious to us. I'm not getting hung up on the diagnosis, is mostly what I'm trying to say. So I want y'all to think about existing diagnoses. Obsessive compulsive disorder. Are y'all second years or first years? Both. Okay. If you think about obsessive compulsive disorder, depression, anxiety, narcissism, to name a few, anorexia. What does social media do with those existing diagnoses? Y'all are free to answer. Or just throw a... If you're suffering with depression and you have your smartphone, what are you going to do?
Distract.
Use it.
Play games
on
social media.
Right.
Google.
Google.
You're crazy.
Yes. If you're a teenager and you're depressed, what do you do?
Post-depressing statuses and hope that you get some.
Yes. Feedback. So we're definitely seeing an increase in developing identity around, quote, depression, which in my opinion often isn't depression in the beginning. It's typical normative adolescent struggle. If I had the ability to post my every thought when I was a teenager, I would be every diagnosis in the DSM. And as y'all know, normative adolescent development and what they experience, there's a lot of similarities between depression symptoms as well. So it's already this fine balance. And as y'all know probably, the world of psychology and the world of medicine is very, very eager to diagnose children and teenagers. Very, very eager. That's another day. It's infuriating. So think about anxiety, narcissism. If you're a narcissist, what do you do when you have social media? Right.
Think about yourself more.
Yes.
Post a lot of selfies.
Post a lot of selfies. So let's say you're a narcissist, that there's some hope of recovery. And you're working with that client in various ways to not self-inflate. And then you go and you post your selfies or whatnot. And you're getting likes. And with every like, that narcissist is getting a dopamine release and further entrenching that behavior in that mindset. And the list goes on. Eating disorders. So with this, as you think about a child's developing brain, if we're looking at just adolescents, right, we're all narcissists when we're adolescents. The world revolves around me. You should be able to read my mind. You are wrong. I am right. That used to be a normal phase that kids grow through and out, right? What I'm pointing to is the likelihood of them getting stuck is very high. The world does revolve around you when you're constantly on social media, constantly getting feedback, either negative or positive. How do you outgrow that? When your brain doesn't stop growing until it's 25, roughly. And so these children are entrenching these behaviors that used to be normative. Their brain is wiring accordingly. And instead of growing up and out, it's getting further and further entrenched. I'm going to be fascinated to see the levels, whoever smart person does this study, on the increase in diagnoses with the generation that began life with a smartphone and moved through the crucial adolescent years with a smartphone. So the addictions, the problem with these addictive-like behaviors, the constant checking, if any of you have struggled with addiction or have loved ones that do, it's the constant nagging and impulse. And I'm going to guess that every single person in this room has had the impulse to check their phone when it really didn't make a lot of logical sense to check it. I'm going to guess everybody in this room, if you are without your phone, if you leave your phone at home, it's almost like prep for a panic attack. There's a lot of reasons for that, but also I want to highlight that, I guess you can look at this positively, is that never before do I think that the average person can relate to an addict like they can now. That impulse, you post a picture. I have my Instagram account, post pictures of my cute babies. The impulse to look. Who liked it? What did they say about my cute children? You know, you can say, oh, our world has become superficial. Yes and no. The reason people keep going back and back and back and back is even in small doses, that like, that comment, it's a dopamine release. So go easy on yourself when you're like, oh my gosh, I've checked my phone. Like, what is wrong with me? Well, your brain's getting a surge. That's why. Same thing that happens with any addict. The irritability in teenagers, the panic if you take a child's phone away, looks just like taking a drug away from an addict. And truly, it is a panic, and I'm going to get into why in a little bit. How frequently do y'all take breaks?
Either every hour, hour and a half.
Okay, I'll go for a little while longer. Do y'all have any questions thus far? Sure. Sure.
I'm curious about the correlation between the desire for connection with this compulsion to check them.
Absolutely.
Because when working with teenagers, that's what I'm seeing a lot, is this is my connection to other people. This is how I learn to socialize. So I have this relationship with a guy over Snapchat, but when we see each other in person, we don't talk.
Correct. Yes, I am, very much so. Barb. Oh, that's so fun to call him Barb.
There's an article in the Wall Street Journal about the shame culture.
Yes.
Are you going to touch on
it? I am.
So I work at Three Oaks, and I'm dealing a lot with teenagers who are sexually acting out on social media.
Yes.
Or like Whisper or, mm-hmm. I mean, they're just, and like predators and like, there's been some really crazy stuff with the amount of naked photos that teenagers are sending of themselves and all that stuff. And I'm wondering how that impacts budding borderlines, and histrionic person, like those kind of personality disorders that are already kind of prevalent in teenagers anyways.
Yes.
I don't know if you're going to address ways to deal with that.
I am. Maybe not specifically. I mean, I can't ask me that question again when we get there. And we can talk about it together. Yes, Pops.
That's Dr. Hurley.
Yes.
I'm just thinking of Skinner's observation, inconsistent reinforcement is the hardest to extinguish. Welcome to the cell phone and the surge you get when it happens to be there. But if not, it literally reinforces further looking.
Yes.
So, boy, you can get it.
The more you click, the more you numb, the more you numb, the more you click. I feel the need to say this. All my life has been in the Bible Belt. I obviously came to school at a conservative seminary. The Christian community is very, very tempted to think that they're a little bit safer. So if any of y'all are sitting in here thinking, well, at least I have. Negative. The statistics are as high in churches. You look at pornography struggles. It's the same. Knowing Christ is not in and of itself protect you or your family or your church community from this any more than it does protect from a pedophile, etc. So I feel like, you know, a lot of times my struggle is, because I think the church needs to take this by the horns for sure. But these words are very taboo in churches. You know, parents come and want to like decapitate the pastor if they mention the idea of talking to children about sex and actually using the word sex or using the word pornography, etc. And so a lot of times leadership in churches, their hands feel really tied. You know, it's a complex organization when you're having to deal with parents. Parents make everything difficult, right? The number one problem with parents is they think, not my kid, in everything, but particularly in this area. I'll save saying that when Barb gets back, because I'm going to tell y'all this in a minute. Okay.
Do you have time for another question?
Yes, absolutely.
Can we go back to one of your earlier, well, you don't have to go back, but you were talking about attachment, especially in infancy, with the mom being distracted. I've talked to a lot of moms who, especially those nighttime babies, which feel like the loneliest in the world, and so they do watch Netflix or they do have like a text group.
Sure.
Would you say that's like a false sense of sanity? Like, how do you
know? Not necessarily. I think that it is, as in all things, it's moderation and self-awareness of the function of it. Because in and of itself, these things aren't innately bad, right? The midnight milk bar that I talked about, it's turned into this community of women. There's like 200 people in it at this point that actually I got kicked off because I shared my thoughts about letting children cry it out and I was kicked out, literally. However, my friends that are still in it, that troll for me, say that it is still it's a support. You know, there's women going through divorces or children diagnosed with autism, children that have died, those sorts of things. So, you know, there are obviously so many positive functions of it. I think the key, as in all things, is self-awareness and what purpose is this serving. And when you're evaluating, like, man, this gets me through the night, then, yeah, you know. I think it's case by case and it's person by person. And it has more to do with self-awareness and more to do with, is it a secondary form of communication and connection or is it a primary? Barb, what I was going to say when you stepped out, but I held back. So when I was in clinic, I really did not like working with men. I thought it was awkward And it's just awkward. I just would rather not deal with the countertransference and all those issues. So Barb, in sharing this with her, essentially gave me a caseload of all men. So I've come a long way. What I was going to speak to is the number of daddies that I have in my office sobbing, finding nude pictures of their 12, 13, 14-year-old daughter naked, some even prepubescent, which at this point, a lot of teenage bodies do look prepubescent, being sent football teams, it's heartbreaking. So, Barb, I've come a long way. I love all the men that come. Mama Lee, okay. I said this. More you click, the number you get, the more you click. So, of all people, I can't encourage you enough. Monica Lewinsky. Were y'all around Monica Lewinsky? I don't do numbers, okay? Has a TED Talk, Barb. It's called The Price of Shame. It is fantastic. And she speaks to being a 21-year-old and falling in love with her boss, as many do. Her problem was that she fell in love with the President of the United States. It happened to be at this cusp of the World Wide Web and social media becoming a thing. It is heartbreaking when you think about that woman. She was a 21-year-old intern in D.C. In the ensuing next decade of her not being able to leave her house, the price of shame. So she's, we don't ever hear about Monica Lewinsky, and this is, I could talk about this all day, but she's resurfaced. And she is lovely in what she speaks to on the shame culture around social media is really, I encourage y'all to all listen to it. You can find it on a TED Talk. And then get really mad that nobody's giving her any credit. All right, desensitization. Okay, so when I was growing up, Strawberry Shortcake and My Little Pony, Strawberry Shortcake particularly, was like this cute little dumpy thing, right? She liked to eat Strawberry Shortcake. And she smelled good, and she was, and then her friend Lemon Meringue, she was dumpy too, because she liked Lemon Meringue, right? My Little Pony, I mean, when Care Bears, funny enough, they were kind of all dumpy, right? Who in here has watched Strawberry Shortcake or My Little Pony recently? My homegirl. So they are sexy. They are tall and thin. If you can make a sexy My Little Pony, they have accomplished it. They have long legs, bigger butts, sassy poofy hair, and the head roll to go with it. Strawberry Shortcake is now long and slender, as are Lemon Meringue and her other buddies. Strawberry Shortcake is still pretty nice, but her friends are not. So Dora also is no longer pudgy. Dora has been elongated. So from a very, very, very young age, the girls are getting messages more so than ever around what constitutes, you know, who they are, what life looks like. What life looks like if you're a little girl is, even if you're a pony, you have long legs and a perfectly proportioned butt. and fancy hair. And you're not playing anymore like Strawberry Shortcake and Lemon Meringue used to do. They're talking and they're being sassy. They're getting in fights and this click over this click, and then the horses come together and then they fight. Not kidding. Y'all should go watch it. It's awful. And always there's a happy ending. Of course there are, but by the time you get to the happy ending, my kid is like emulating the worst one in there, the worst pony there is. So cartoons are not for kids. Very few of them are. It is a grooming. These cartoons are grooming children to the next level. So the statistic is you're always, no matter whether you're watching Dora on the computer, on YouTube, whatever, you are always three clicks away from a porn site. Three clicks. Now, if you peel back the layers on who drives internet traffic, who drives cartoon industry, Hollywood, etc., you find the billion-dollar pornography industry. They know what they're doing. So in and of itself, yeah, you tell someone that pornography is behind My Little Pony and they look at you like you have three heads. I don't advise telling that to like the person on the street. However, it's a grooming. Three clicks. So what happens when your three-year-old is bored of My Little Pony? They get to watch the Disney Channel. By the way, all of these are banned in my house. We don't have cable. They move on to the Disney Channel. Who's watched the Disney Channel recently? And by Disney, I'm speaking to the, like, tween shows. So if you are a male growing up and you are watching these shows, you know what you are? You're a moron. And it's okay to make fun of you and to offer no sense of emotional care. You're treated like a stupid boy. And the girls, they can make fun of you with no consequence, but you do it to them and there's great consequence. It teaches disrespect. Like, pops, you should assign them a paper of watching the Disney Channel and genogram it or whatever y'all need to do. And so some kids can watch this and filter it out. Some. Most. I mean, these are their, this is what they emulate. Now, I want you to think back to that statistic in the beginning. On average, they're watching about 9 hours. So, YouTube, after the break, I'm going to pull this up. I know that many of you know this, but on YouTube, you search something, Dora, and then it prompts you to look at other videos. Let's say it'll prompt you to look at iCarly or whatever the show is on Disney. So then you click on that, and it becomes increasingly mature content. And no more than, if you're just clicking on that, you know, you get to pornography really quickly. Ever tried search puppy in the search engine on YouTube? Or don't. But I'll tell y'all that my little girl, she was 4 or 5. And she came home and said, Mama, I was at Chloe's house and we were trying to find pictures of cute puppies. And this lady making weird noises and she didn't have any clothes on came up. average age, and I'm going to get into this, that a kid has seen porn is 8 years old. So, not a happy talk. modeling by parents and siblings, right? So, like, right now in my house, my five-year-old wants desperately to wear, well, she wants a shoe with a heel on it because her sister got one that has, like, that much of a heel on it. So that's what she's aiming for, right? When you're younger, you want to be what your older sister or brother is engaging in. And beyond that, you're setting the norm for, as parents, of what adult life looks like. So if adult life looks like you driving down the road and checking your phone, even though they're getting their phone taken away for doing the same thing, right? So if you're saying, honey, the reason you can't watch more than so-and-so hours is because I love your brain and it's better off doing other things. But then you're clued in. What message does that send? That this boundary is only temporary and it only applies to young children, right? So, you know, as y'all know, it's infiltrated our culture. My oldest, God love her. We need to, like, be living in Little House on the Prairie. She was like, Mom, I could post that on YouTube. She doesn't know what YouTube is. I could post that on YouTube, and, I mean, it would be, like, a nationwide hit. She has no idea what she's talking about, obviously. My point is she hears people talking about YouTube. She doesn't really know what it is. She just knows she needs to know what it is, right? It's all around them. All around them. And I'm going to get into that, the solution around this, which is not to cut them off for forever. Instagram and hashtags. So I would say of the apps that children use, Instagram is probably the most benign. When my daughter is allowed to have a social media account, Instagram will be what she is allowed to at first. So who here has an Instagram account? Actually, I'm going to stop there, and I'm going to pull up my Instagram account so I can show this to some of you who may or may not know that Instagram particularly is not just an app. It is the World Wide Web. And parents have a lot of misunderstanding of how Instagram works. And by the way, Facebook, kids don't do Facebook anymore. It's like old people. They laugh. You have a Facebook account? So that's like what parents do, is Facebook. The kids, most of them don't even have a Facebook account. So why don't we break and y'all come back. How long do y'all break? 5, 10 minutes? 5, 10 minutes. Well, I'm just going to say I'm starting talking at 9:10 straight on the 2.